From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Orson Welles' 1958 film Touch of Evil is a classic that has influenced a generation of directors. But Welles hated the movie because the studio recut the film against his will, undermining his concept for the film's look and structure. Welles wrote a 58-page memo critiquing the studio cut and explaining his concept. That memo is the basis of a new restored version of Touch of Evil. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Walter Murch, who edited the new version and did the sound. Also, as the 100th anniversary of George Gershwin's birth approaches, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a reissue of Porgy and Bess and new recordings of music from the opera. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton's personal attorneys have asked independent counsel Kenneth Starr to give them an advance look at the report he is preparing to send to Congress. It is expected to include material on the original Whitewater investigation, as well as the scandal involving former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. The president's attorneys want the opportunity to write a rebuttal that would also be forwarded to Congress. Any evidence in the Starr report could be used to open discussion of censure or even impeachment of the president. The group responsible for last month's bombing in Omagh, Northern Ireland, has declared a, quote, complete cessation of all military activity. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The so-called Real IRA made its announcement in a telephone call to RTE, the Irish state broadcaster. 29 people died in the Omagh attack, and the revulsion against the group cut across every single section of Irish society. Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern said the group's ceasefire was important and a positive development, but added that the British and Irish governments would not swerve from their unrelenting determination to pursue the bombers. Meanwhile, yesterday in Belfast, leaders of the political parties elected to the new Northern Ireland Assembly met for an hour. The meeting was chaired by the Assembly's First Minister, David Trimble, leader of the largest Protestant party, the Ulster Unionists. Among those attending was Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams. The two men spoke directly to each other for the very first time. A one-to-one meeting between the pair is scheduled for Thursday. Michael Goldfarb, NPR News, London.
Police in Aurora, Colorado, have a 17-year-old suspect in custody after a shooting spree yesterday that killed six people. One of the dead is also one of the suspects, NPR's Mark Roberts reports.
The murders took place in two homes not far apart in an upscale Aurora neighborhood. Witnesses reportedly told police two young men wearing bandanas and carrying shotguns broke into a house and shot a mother and two teenagers to death. A few blocks away, police found two teenage boys shot to death in another home. The body of 18-year-old Michael Martinez, a suspect in the killings, was then discovered in a field some 10 miles away. Police do not think Martinez's death was a suicide. Instead, they think another suspect in the shootings killed Martinez. Police took a 17-year-old boy into custody, but declined to give his name. At this point, it's uncertain which home was attacked first, and police say they have no motive for the murders. Mark Roberts, NPR News, Denver.
New York Governor George Pataki has called out the National Guard to help people in nine counties recover from bad storms. Hundreds of Guard members will cut up fallen trees and pick up other heavy debris. Two separate storms, Sunday night and yesterday, spread damage from West Virginia to Connecticut. Some wind gusts were gauged at 100 miles per hour. Five people were killed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 227 points at 78.68. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, there's been a big boost for the stock market today as investors and traders come back from the long Labor Day weekend. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Corvett's back to work for Wall Street today, and what a way to start a holiday-shortened trading week. On optimism, the Federal Reserve Board might actually consider cutting interest rates. Stocks rallied today. At one point, the Dow Industrial Average had risen by 300 points, or roughly 4%. That is three-quarters of what the market lost last week. Still, some analysts say they are not convinced the Fed will actually cut rates anytime soon. In other news, New York-based Metropolitan Life announced today that it plans to eliminate 10% of its non-sales-related workforce. That could amount to just under 2,000 jobs. And later today, the government releases its latest numbers on consumer borrowing. Most experts think there were fewer people taking out loans in July. They predict a $3 billion rise in borrowing compared to a $6.7 billion increase in June. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Officials for Northwest Airlines and striking pilots will meet in separate rooms with mediators today who will urge them to return to the bargaining table. This is the 12th day of the pilot strike. No progress is reported. Northwest, based in Minnesota, is also the only major airline to serve North Dakota. And that state's senators are urging President Clinton to step in with executive power to call a cooling-off period. But the White House says Mr. Clinton wants both sides in the dispute to work out the problems on their own. Belgium has minted new coins for the European Union's new currency, the euro. Belgium's King Albert II was on hand as the coins were issued. These euros will be held until the currency becomes accepted on the street in 2001. The euro will be the common currency of 11 European nations. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1958 film Touch of Evil is generally acknowledged as one of Orson Welles' great achievements, but the film was first released by Universal as a B-movie and was a commercial flop. The audience never saw exactly what Welles had intended. The studio did the final cut, and that version infuriated Welles. In response, he fired off a 58-page memo explaining his original intentions. The complete memo was recently tracked down by Rick Schmidlin, who has produced a new version of Touch of Evil that follows Welles' intentions as outlined in the memo. My guest Walter Murch was the film editor and re-recording mixer on The Restoration, which opens Friday. Murch won editing and sound mixing Oscars for The English Patient. He also worked on Apocalypse Now, The Godfather Trilogy, and The Conversation. Touch of Evil is set in a seedy town on the Mexican border. Charlton Heston plays a Mexican narcotics officer honeymooning with his new bride, played by Janet Leigh. Their honeymoon is quickly interrupted by a bomb explosion, which Heston feels compelled to investigate, but he's up against a corrupt American police chief, played by Orson Welles. Murch describes the opening shot of the film as a Rosetta Stone for film students, a shot that is logistically and technically very difficult, which was made to look effortless.
The shot is a 3.5-minute long single take, which involves the population of an entire city, a very lively border town at the crossing between the United States and Mexico. And you begin on the Mexican side of the border with a big close-up of a pair of hands putting a bomb in a car, turning the clock to 3 minutes and 20 seconds, which justifiably becomes the entire length of the shot. So he predicts right at the beginning of the shot how long the shot will be, because that's when the bomb will go off. And then the camera cranes way up into the sky and has a overview of this entire street and this almost the entire city, and then drops way down to street level, sees people on the street, and then picks up Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh, who play the leads in the film. And then the car with the bomb in it comes into the shot and leaves the shot, and then there's some other bit of business, and the car comes back. So it's a very complicated shot that ends with a whole dialogue scene, still part of the same shot. And then the dialogue scene ends, the Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh go off, and they have a kiss, and then right when in the middle of their kiss, the bomb goes off. So everything is contained except for that final bomb within this single shot.
Now, in the released version of the movie, this spectacular shot is obscured by the opening credits. And also, Henry Mancini music plays, you know, the opening credit music plays over this entire scene. Now, that's not what Orson Welles wanted. What did he want?
Well, let me just read you from his memo. This is a document that he wrote in a single night. It's about 58 pages long. And he was allowed by the studio to see his film one time only. He had been fired off the film effectively 4 months before the film was finished. And those are 4 extremely critical months in the life of any film. He saw what they'd done to it. He saw that they had written new scenes, added new dialogue, shot whole new sections of the film. And this is his response. He begins, actually, with talking about this very thing. This is Orson Welles talking now. "I assume that the music now backing the opening sequence of the picture is temporary. In fact, it was not. This was Henry Mancini's title music. Then, as the camera moves through the streets of the Mexican border town, the plan was to feature a succession of different and contrasting Latin American musical numbers, the effect, that is, of our passing one cabaret orchestra after another. In honky-tonk districts on the border, loudspeakers are all over the entrance of every joint, large or small, each blasting out its own tune by way of a come-on or pitch. The special use of contrasting mambo-type rhythm numbers with rock and roll will be developed in some detail at the end of this memo, when I'll take up the details of the beat and also specifics of musical color and instrumentation on a scene-by-scene, transition-by-transition basis. You can get from that paragraph the depth of detail that he was going to go into in this memo. But what we read there was our instructions from Wells about what to do. Once the titles had been eliminated from that opening shot, and we were very lucky to find what's called a textless background, which is just the images without any titles on it. So we found that negative, and we were able to use that to integrate into the rest of the film and have that shot have no titles over it. So now you can see everything that's going on in the shot. The way it was, you had to look around the titles to see what was actually happening in it, which Wells hated.
Now, had Wells recorded all the sound that he wanted to use there? And if so, did you have access to that recording? Or did you have to do the sound from scratch for that opening scene?
Well, that's another interesting thing. We actually found the original sound for that scene. Not the music part, which I had to manufacture by lifting pieces from other places in the film, of music that he had also used in the film. Strip joint music, rock and roll music, mambo, cha-cha music, all coming out of little tinny loudspeakers, which he had recorded. But once the Henry Mancini original title music was on, the studio made the decision to eliminate almost everything of the effects track, the sound track that Wells had also produced. So the sound of people walking, the sound of the crowd, the sound of a group of goats that they come across in the middle of the shot, the car sounds, all of this was really absent. And when you heard the previous version of the film, your memory is of nothing except Henry Mancini's music. So by eliminating Mancini's music, we were also, surprisingly, because we didn't know it was there, we were able to reveal this whole other dimension to the film, which has never been heard before.
Let's hear how that opening scene sounds. We won't hear all 3 minutes of it, but we'll hear some of it and hear that kind of a very varied sense of different cultures in one town that he wanted to establish in this opening.
Okay.
That sound from the opening shot of the re-edited version of Touch of Evil, and my guest Walter Murch is the person who did the editing and the re-recording mixing for this new release of the film. Now, I believe Orson Welles, in this long memo that he wrote to the studio telling them why they should do the film the way he wanted it cut, he said that the sound in this scene should be as bad as it would have been in real life. I mean, he wanted the sound from these speakers and car radios to be really tinny, like in real life. So that's instructions that you followed.
Yes, absolutely. This was a very revolutionary thing at the time. In 1958, when you made a film and you put music to it, everyone's impulse was to make the music sound as good as possible. This is roughly the equivalent of when you're shooting a scene in a slum. Even though it's a slum, it's not really dirty. There's a whole other aesthetic that says, make it as dirty as possible. And that was what Welles was following in his use of music here. Again, let me just read from his memo. And I should emphasize that this is the only time in the whole memo that he goes into a narrow column with capitals. It's very big. It says, it is very important to note that in the recording of all these numbers, which are supposed to be heard through street loudspeakers, that the effect should be just that, just exactly as bad as that. The music itself should be skillfully played, but it will not be enough in doing the final sound to run this track through an echo chamber. To get the effect we're looking for, it is absolutely vital that this music be played back through a cheap speaker in the alley outside the sound building. Since this is not very expensive, I feel justified in insisting upon this, as the result will really be worth it. Now, right in that, you can get a sense of how mysterious Orson Welles was to the studios, because here he's saying at the beginning of it, it should be as bad as it really is, as bad as possible. And at the end, he says, the result will really be worth it. And this was a mentality, certainly at Universal in the late 1950s, that people just had a hard time understanding. But it adds to the realism. And since that time, this technique is now universally applied in film. But in 1958, it was completely outside of anyone's experience.
Were there sounds that you had to re-record for this opening?
No, we didn't. We didn't record anything for any of the changes that we made. Occasionally something is in a slightly different place, as per his request, but nothing new was added to the film.
My guest is Walter Murch. He edited and remixed the new restored version of Orson Welles' 1958 film Touch of Evil. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Murch. He edited and remixed the new restored version of Orson Welles' 1958 film, Touch of Evil. Now, let's get to another scene that you changed the audio track of. You suggested that we talk about the scene between Orson Welles and Marlena Dietrich early on in the film. And Welles plays the chief of police, and he's come... Dietrich is a prostitute, and he's come to see her. Tell us about this scene and why you made a change in it.
Well, this is the first scene in the film that has any personal dimension to it at all. And at the end of the film, the Dietrich character is the person who sums up Welles, and in fact, she's the last person that we see in the whole film, saying adios. That's her last line. So what we see here is the meeting of two old lovers. It's not explicitly stated, but it's definitely implied. And she doesn't recognize him because it's been 10 or 15 years, and he's gained a lot of weight. He looks terrible. He's eating a candy bar. He speaks kind of a slurred voice. And she just thinks he's another drunk who came in off the street. In fact, it's this character, Quinlan, the head of police, with whom she had a relationship some years earlier. What's remarkable about the scene is that it has this real-life resonance between Orson Welles and Marlena Dietrich, who apparently were an item sometime during the mid-1940s, so that what you see is Tana meeting Quinlan, in fact, is the identical scene to Marlena Dietrich meeting Orson Welles again. If you listen to the dialogue, you can imagine the double dimension that's going on. The significant change in the soundtrack is the elimination of the music halfway through the scene. It comes to its own natural end, I should say. This is what Wells wanted. Again, we didn't do anything in the film that he didn't tell us to do. But what that does, interestingly, is articulate the scene into two separate parts. There is a atmospheric part at the beginning where there's this kind of smoky reverie of the past, and boy, you sure look good. You look like a mess. Stop eating those candy bars, kind of thing. And then they get down to brass tacks. Did you hear the bomb? Did you hear anything about who might have planted the bomb? And she stiffs him. She won't give any answer. But you're dealing with the plot. So the scene is divided into two separate sections, and the music underlying it emphasizes the difference between those two sections.
Well, let's hear that scene.
We're closed.
You've been cooking at this hour?
Just cleaning up.
Oh. Have you forgotten your old friend?
I told you we were closed.
I'm Hank Quinlan.
I didn't recognize you. You should lay off those candy bars.
It's either the candy or the hooch. I must say, I wish it was your chili I was getting fat on. Anyway, you're sure looking good.
You're a mess, honey.
Yeah. That being old, it sure brings back memories.
The customers go for it. It's old, it's new. We got the television, too. We run movies. What can I offer you?
You haven't heard anything about that bomb, have you?
That happened on your side of the border.
In a place like this, you hear things.
I heard the explosion.
Well, this case is over. Let's come around some night, sample some of your chili.
Better be careful. Maybe too hot for you.
My guest is Walter Murch, and he is the editor and re-recording mixer of the new release of Orson Welles' 1958 film, Touch of Evil. It must have been so interesting to work with Orson Welles' memo about this film, about the way he really wanted it, because he pays such attention to sound. Orson Welles is famous early in his career for War of the Worlds, the radio show that was a fiction that people took seriously, and he had quite an ear for sound because of his work with radio. So what was that like for you to, in some ways, work with Orson Welles on sound?
Well, it was remarkable all the way through. The memo, which will be published later on this year or early next year by the University of California Press, is so discursive and descriptive and evocative. It's funny, it's ironic, it's sad because of why he was forced to write this memo. The film was being taken away from him. But you feel so much in his presence that while I was working on the film, I could easily imagine that Orson had just gone to take a nap on the sofa in the next room and that he had left me these notes and that I was letting him rest and I would make these changes. And when they were done, I'd wake him up and say, "What do you think?" So that this is in no sense a laundry list of things to do. You're getting the full tilt of Orson Welles' articulate personality. As far as sound goes, it was also remarkable, primarily because of that excerpt that I read earlier. This is a device that I fell upon, I believed, on my own account sometime in the late 1960s.
With the device of making music sound cheap and bad as opposed to just
going to make it sound like it's
possible.
To make it sound like it's really coming from the place that it's supposed to be coming from, a real speaker in a little radio, mm-hmm. Or whatever it happens to be. And George Lucas and I did a whole a whole film about nothing but this concept when we did American Graffiti, which was using essentially exactly the same technique that Orson Welles is describing here, except he was doing it and describing it 15 years earlier. This part of the memo is something that has just come to light within the last 4 or 5 months. So this is new information to not only to me, but to everybody.
Let's talk a little bit more about this memo. Orson Welles wrote this memo in response to seeing the studio's recut version of his film, in which they also filmed new material and added it without his knowledge or against his will. And he was so angry that he immediately fired off this very long memo. Why did the studio re-edit his movie in the first place?
Well, it has a tremendous amount to do with the dynamics of any studio, but particularly Universal at that time, which was known as King of the Bees. They made very good B pictures, or rather pictures that fit the second half of a double bill very good. They are the equivalent of what would be called television movies today. The whole concept of B movies has disappeared and it's been replaced by television. And so they had a formula. It's like we're McDonald's and we make hamburgers, and the McDonald's hamburgers have a certain kind of taste. We don't want you fancy French chefs coming in here and telling us how to make our hamburgers. So Orson Welles had been living in Europe over the last 10 years. He had made Citizen Kane arguably the greatest film ever made. And he was coming in and fooling around with their hamburger recipe, and they just resented it, especially when they saw the final results, when they saw what he had edited. So it was from that point on that he was kept at arm's length from the film, and they simply applied their usual logic to this film. This film being such an extraordinary film, it doesn't really accept that kind of logic. So I think the greatest thing about what we've done is we've allowed this film to return to its original voice that it has never been heard from in the last 40 years.
We'll talk more with Walter Murch about restoring Touch of Evil in the second half of the show. Here's more sound from the opening scene with Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You folks are American citizens?
I am, yes.
Where were you born, miss?
Mrs.
What?
Philadelphia.
The name is Vargas.
Hey, Jim. See who's here?
Sure, Mr. Vargas. Out on the trail of another dope ring?
Out on the trail of a chocolate soda for my wife.
Your wife?
Tell your bride, officer.
Hey, can I get through?
A lot of talk up here about how you cracked that Grandy business.
Yeah, I hear you caught the big boss.
Only one of them. The Grandys are a big family. Good night.
No purchases, Mr. Lineker.
Hey, I've got this...
You're an American citizen, miss?
No, I got this ticking noise.
Yeah, okay.
No, really, this
good
ticking
night.
Noise in my head.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL, keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a reissue of Porgy and Bess and a new recording of music from the opera, and we continue our conversation with Walter Murch about restoring Orson Welles' film Touch of Evil. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Walter Murch. He was the editor and sound remixer for the new restored version of Orson Welles' 1958 film Touch of Evil. The studio took the film away from Welles and did a final cut that violated his intentions. The restored version, which opens in 50 cities this Friday, follows Welles' 58-page memo which critiqued the studio cut and explained his own vision. When we left off, Murch was explaining that the studio was afraid that Welles' cut was too arty and sophisticated for most viewers to follow. Now, one of the things that the studio changed was Orson Welles' cross-cutting in the movie. There are two main characters, Janet Leigh and Charlton Heston, play an American and a Mexican who have just married. He's a cop. And the story kind of alternates between her point of view and his point of view. He's investigating the murder while she's getting terrorized by the bad guys. And the film cuts back and forth, and I guess the studio found that really confusing.
Yeah, that's an excellent example of what I was just talking about. This happens in the opening reel of the film, and Welles had intended the two stories, that the married couple gets separated quite soon after this explosion, and for the rest of the film, really, we're following their two independent stories, which finally get linked up together during the climax. This was also not a usual technique for any films in 1958, particularly B films. So they felt, at least in the opening reel, let's make it all normal. We'll just play the whole scenes. We'll play them out as they were intended to be as full scenes. This is their interpretation. The trouble with that is that you're grafting on the limb of a tree onto an animal. That the two things just don't mesh. The whole film is about cross-cutting. So if you make the first reel not be about cross-cutting, then you're essentially teaching the audience to understand this film in a different language than the rest of the film will be. So that was probably the main note that Orson had in this entire 58-page memo was restore my cross-cutting. It's essential because each story is equivalent. The man's story is just as important as the woman's story and vice versa. And I want each time we go back and forth for it to be not too long and for each section to be just about the same length. The way it was, you spent 5 or 6 minutes with Charlton Heston. Janet Leigh was long gone by that point. So at the end of 5 minutes, you probably thought you were justified in thinking, yeah, this film is about Charlton Heston. So then when it goes to Janet Leigh and her story, you're thrown for a loop.
How would you describe the tone of his letter? Is he writing in anger or writing more as a director and film critic?
Also, a very interesting question. Let me just find the right example of it here. The tone of the memo is, let's say, diplomatic. He knows who he's talking to. He knows that if he gets mad, they will not do anything he wants. On the other hand, he really is mad. So this is a director and a writer who has had his picture taken away from him and new material put in it. So here's the excerpt that I think best captures that mood. My effort has been to keep scrupulous care that this memo should avoid those wide and sweeping denunciations of your new material to which my own position naturally and sorely tempts me. In this one instance, I'm passing on to you a reaction based not on my conviction as to what my picture ought to be, and he underlines that, but only what here strikes me as significantly mistaken in your picture. It's sufficiently your own by now for me to be able to judge it on what I take to be your terms alone, and to bring to that judgment, after so much time away from the film in any form, a certain freshness of eye. So he's letting them feel a little lick of the whip, but at the same time, he's making this concession to them, which is, listen, you've taken it away. You're doing something to it. It's not mine anymore. I would not be doing anything of what you're doing.
Now, what did you think of the extra footage that the studio commissioned to add to the Orson Welles movie? Did you keep any of it in your version?
Some of it was unavoidably kept because it replaced scenes that Orson had shot but which were subsequently destroyed by the studio. In the one case that it was a completely new scene that was not in the original shooting, we were able to eliminate it quite easily. It's enough to know that it represented probably 10 minutes of film, and it was shot in a day. And for those of you who know anything about filmmaking, that's an extremely fast rate. People are sometimes lucky to get one or two pages a day. So it tended to look flat and very hasty. Not enough concern is taken with Charlton Heston's makeup. The dialogue is clunky. It's making plot points, but making them rather baldly. And the lighting is not that interesting. So it must have been very dispiriting for Orson, with a greatest cameraman as Russell Metty, to see both his work and Russell Metty's work replaced by a television director and, I think, an anonymous cameraman.
Touch of Evil is a kind of film that can be studied in film school. It wasn't meant to be an art film. It was produced by Albert Zugsmith, who also made Written on the Wind, The Incredible Shrieking Man, Slaughter on 10th Avenue, not to mention High School Confidential, and Teacher Was a Sex Pot. What's the story of how Orson Welles ended up doing this film with Albert Zugsmith?
Well, this was a Zugsmith production from the beginning. He was a staff director at Universal, did most of his films for Universal. And they had somehow landed Charlton Heston in this film. Apparently the script was not that good. He'd just done one of his big biblical epics. I forget which
Ten
one.
Ten Commandments, I think.
Ten Commandments, yeah. And so he was a big star. And so it's not clear to me why he would take on this film, but he did. And in talking to him about who should direct this film, Charlton said, well, I hear Orson Welles is available. Why don't we get him? Because they were also considering maybe using Welles to act only in the film as this corrupt Texas police detective. So they talked to Orson, and they said, if you would direct this film for the same money that you're getting to act in the film, would you do it? In other words, we should get two for one. You can direct and act in it, and we'll just pay you the money you would have gotten for acting. Orson was so desperate to actually make a film at this time, because it had been 10 years since he'd done anything in Hollywood, that he said, absolutely. And in fact, he took on the rewriting of the script himself and changed substantially many things about the original novel and screenplay. So he wrote, directed, and acted in this film, all for his acting salary. And so it was Charlton Heston's idea, I believe, to bring him into the film, just because Heston wanted to work with Welles.
There's a story that may or may not be apocryphal, maybe you'll know. And the story is that Orson Welles was talking to the producer, Zugsmith, and said, you know, I want to make a movie. What's the absolute worst script that you have on file now? And Zugsmith gave him this screenplay for a film that was then called Badge of Evil. And Welles said, I'll take it. Welles rewrote it and fashioned it into Touch of Evil. Is that a true story, do you know?
I've heard that story, too. Both stories may be true in some element. I can't. The only person who's alive now who can really tell us is Charlton Heston. So I'm taking what he says as some indication of what actually happened. But the Zugsmith story might well have happened. It sounds like Welles.
Do you think that in some ways this 1958 Albert Zugsmith production still is, in some ways, an exploitation film?
Yeah, I think so. It Orson Welles, as you indicated, he was never wanting to reach the elite art market. He wanted to get into people's living rooms. That's his whole drive to do radio, was to get intimate with everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Orson Welles. He wanted that sound to reverberate throughout America, and it was a great frustration of his career that he got labeled with this boy genius idea and was thought to be too refined for the American taste. He enjoyed all of that stuff as much as anyone. And I think that's one of the reasons he responded to this film. There are whole sections of the film where Janet Leigh is being menaced by a bunch of hoodlums in a motel.
While wearing her slip.
Yeah, she's wearing this, she's half naked, wearing bodice ripper type underwear and pajamas. It's all very suggestive material. And you hear this pounding rock and roll music and drug addicts getting high in the next room. And they break into her room, and it's just to the point that they're going to do something unmentionable to her. The door slams in our face, and we never know really what happened there, but you're left to your own imagination. This section, by the way, I should add, is something that was lifted almost in its entirety by Alfred Hitchcock and put into Psycho, which was made at a couple of years later. Starring Janet Leigh in a motel, the Bates Motel, menaced by a strange motel keeper who also exists in Touch of Evil, played by Dennis Weaver. You got Anthony Perkins in Psycho, the same art director as Touch of Evil. Wells was mad that happened, and especially mad that Psycho made a whole lot of money and Touch of Evil didn't.
Well, Hitchcock doesn't close the door in the shower scene.
Janet Leigh dies. Whereas in this movie, you're left to think she was injected with heroin and raped, although there are some lines later on in the film that say it was just a joke. Whether it was or not, we never really know.
We'll talk more with Walter Murch about restoring the Orson Welles film Touch of Evil after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Murch. He's the editor and sound remixer of the new restored version of Orson Welles' 1958 film Touch of Evil. Are there things that you think are done with sound or with editing today that weren't done in Orson Welles' time that you've been thinking a lot about since reworking his 1958 film?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly, the sophistication with which we do this technique with the music has improved tremendously. Technically, there's been revolution after revolution. That's not significant to me. I mean, I enjoy the new technology as much as anyone, but the most significant things about sound are what is done creatively with the sound, not as what's done technically. Technically can only add a certain sheen or burnish onto something already interesting. If it's not interesting to begin with, then it just becomes an empty sound. I think the level of his involvement in the soundtrack is unprecedented. On that level, I don't think anyone does what Orson Welles does anymore. He was a director who thought in sound terms. He had an entire background in radio. He was the greatest radio dramatist in investigating the idea, the concept of radio drama in the late 1930s. And what he was able to do, remarkably, was to fuse the aesthetics of radio drama with an extremely heightened visual sense, which was remarkable and completely unanticipated when you looked at what he had done up to the age of 23. Nothing of his remarkable control of visuals is really predicted by what he did. But you see these two things coming together, and the amazing thing is that they don't cancel each other out, that you're able to swallow this heightened visual sense that he uses and also not feel that this fully developed naturalistic soundtrack is invasive at all.
Do you feel you picked up any new ideas or new techniques by remixing and re-editing Touch of Evil?
No, I didn't. But I kept stumbling over what I thought were my own traces and finding out that Orson had already been there. It was like Robinson Crusoe finding Friday's footprint. He documented page after page. He's asking for things that I came upon intuitively or maybe subconsciously from having looked at his films. I don't know. But you can arguably say that the last 40 or 50 years have, on a creative sense, been simply a working out of the things that Orson Welles laid down in the 1940s and 50s.
That said, do you think you would have wanted to work with him? He had such a reputation for being temperamental, for not always being able to finish projects that he started.
Well, it was certainly nice to have everything written down like this and to be able to pursue it at our own rate and just to imagine him taking a nap in the next room. I found myself sitting opposite Robert Wise about 4 or 5 months ago. He was the original, he was the editor on Citizen Kane. He's now in his mid-80s, a world-famous director, directing career after having been a very well-known editor. Sound of Music, West Side Story, films like that. And I said, Mr. Wise, it's ironic, I think, that here we are at the same table, and you were Orson Welles' first editor, and here am I, his last and current editor, 50 years after the fact. And he chuckled and said, yep, Orson's problem was his attention span. He just couldn't pay attention long enough to finish a film. And you hear that a lot, and I don't know how true it is, but it's certainly an attitude that many people have after having worked with Welles. He apparently, one of the crises on Touch of Evil was precipitated by the fact that the original editor on Touch of Evil, was so overwhelmed by being in Welles' presence, overwhelmed not only by his personality and his physical presence, but by the range of ideas that Orson would come up with, that this editor apparently froze up. He couldn't work anymore. He was caught between the demands of the studio, finish this film, well, you have to get control of this man, and yet he was trying to control Orson Welles, which nobody could control. And then also trying to respond, like any editor should, to the requests of the director, except that I'm imagining that the director would come in with one set of ideas on Monday, and then by Wednesday would come in really excited about something completely different for that same scene. We didn't have that problem, obviously, because all we have is this text, and Orson Welles is dead. But from all reports, yes, he was a fascinating but difficult and maybe sometimes maddening person to actually work with.
In a way, the studio's misdeed, which was a foolish re-edit of the Orson Welles original version of Touch of Evil, has been a stroke of luck for you. Because you get to kind of immerse yourself in Orson Welles and to remake the movie. It must have been fascinating work.
Well, yeah, that's the glory and the tragedy of having these 58 pages of notes. The tragedy is that we have them at all, because the reason we have them is that he was fired off of his film, and that effectively marked the end of the major stage of his career. He made some films after Touch of Evil, and some of them are wonderful films, but they're not what he really wanted to do, which was to make mainstream studio films with the enthusiastic backing of the studio. And so a career that started with Citizen Kane ended about 20 years later with the release of Touch of Evil. But the fact that this tragedy happened means that we actually have his writing about what he wanted, and he doesn't document in any other form on any of his other films. He doesn't give us documentation about what his thought processes were. So for film history and for film education, this is a fantastic development, because it allows you actually to see into the mind, both the creative and the political mind of one of the great filmmakers of the 20th century, and to actually see the results of having done this project.
Walter Murch, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Walter Murch edited and remixed the new restored version of Orson Welles' 1958 film, Touch of Evil. The restored version opens in 50 cities this Friday. Murch is now working on Anthony Minghella's adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings of Porgy and Bess. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This month marks the centennial of George Gershwin's birth. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of two noteworthy releases of music from Gershwin's most ambitious work, Porgy and Bess.
After Porgy and Bess opened in 1935, it took 16 years to get a complete recording. In 1951, Columbia Records' Goddard Lieberson, who would become responsible for his company's extraordinary series of Broadway original cast albums, produced it with care and originality. It was one of the first opera recordings to use sound effects, like rolling dice or the sounds of a fight, and established an approach still going today. This album has the strongest cast of any complete version. New York City opera baritone Lawrence Winters, who had a bigger career in Germany than in this country, is vocally shining and characterizes the crippled but optimistic Porgy with profound honesty. He matches Todd Duncan, the original Porgy, by not trying to imitate him. This recording restores the powerful buzzard song, which Gershwin cut before the New York opening. Winters gives it the eloquent intensity of a great Schubert song.
Buzzard, on your way! All ain't what is you, anyhow, not but being lonely. Pack your things and fly from here, carry grief and pain. There's two folks living in this shelter, eating, sleeping, singing, praying. Ain't no such thing as loneliness. And Pog is young, oh girl.
Avon Long, as Sport and Life, the cynical, seductive drug pusher, is equally impressive. The smoothest talking and smoothest singing Sport and Life on record. All snake oil and venom. Who could resist?
There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me. That's where we belong. Sister, you and me can live that high life in New York. Come with me. There, we can't go wrong. Sister, I'll buy you the swellest mansion up on Upper Fifth Avenue. And through Harlem we'll go strutting, we'll go strutting, and there'll be nothing too good for you. I'll dress you in...
To ensure authenticity, Columbia included five members of the original Porgy and Bess company, including Helen Dowdy, the Strawberry Woman, and the best one you've ever heard. There have been some Gershwin discoveries since 1951, and you can hear some of these on a new album of Porgy excerpts with Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops. Gershwin's original version of the opening scene of Act III is an elegiac requiem trio for Bess, Serena, and Maria. This is followed by Bess and Serena's lullaby, Lonely Boy, which Gershwin dropped during the Boston tryout in exchange for Bess's reprise of Summertime, which Anne Brown, the original Bess, otherwise wouldn't have gotten to sing. Here are Angela Brown and the splendid Marquita Lister. Kunzel also gives us a fascinating bit of musical history. The first recording of the original version of Gershwin's first opera, the one-act Blue Monday, opera a la Afro-American, which was performed once on Broadway by white singers in blackface. Later, it was retitled 135th Street and reorchestrated. But the cut I'm sure everyone will keep coming back to is It Ain't Necessarily So, sung by the performer who was allegedly the model for Sportin' Life, Cab Calloway. It was his very last recording, made in 1993, the year before he died. He was 86 years old, and he's amazing.
It ain't necessarily so.
It ain't necessarily so.
The things that you're liable reading the Bible ain't necessarily so. Little David was small, but oh my.
Little David was small, but oh my.
He fought big Goliath who laid down and died. Little David was small, but oh my.
Lord Schwartz reviewed the reissue of the first complete recording of Porgy and Bess on Sony's Masterworks series, and selections from Porgy and Bess with Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops on Telarc. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.